You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
What did you say, Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the Rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. Today, my guest is Moby. One of the biggest stars in dance music ever. His album Play was platinum in more than 20 countries and is considered not only one of the best dance music albums, but among the greatest albums of all time. What's so interesting about this, and I'm really excited to share the talk that we had with you, is Moby's been through tremendous ups and downs, more than most any of us can even imagine. You know, the heights of success, the depths of depression and reinvention. And, you know, he's incredibly forthcoming about all of it and talks me through, you know, a lot of what he went through and what it's like on the other side and what he's continuing to go through and you know, how he approaches making music and all that now. He's also just launched his own label and is continuing to release his own music as well as working with other artists. And it's a really fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Let's go. Hey man, thanks for doing this. Really excited to meet you finally after following you for all these years. And looks like you got some really exciting stuff happening. So I'm excited to hear what you're doing with the label and all of it.
Okay, great.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely want to talk about the label and some upcoming projects. there's a little bit of history I'd like to dig into to kind of get us to this point. And I always like to kind of start at the very beginning for people. So do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
Yeah, I absolutely do. The first record I bought was a 7-inch, and it would have been in the mid-70s. And it was Convoy by C.W. McCall.
No way.
And I remember it so profoundly clearly. I was with my friend Ron Little, and I was living in Stratford, Connecticut, and he found $5 in a drain. And keep in mind, we were, I don't know, 9 or 10 years old. So at that point, $5 was like an unheard of ridiculous amount of money. And he gave me one of the, like he gave me $1 out of the $5. And my mom drove us to this low rent discount store called Bradley's. Anyone who grew up on the East Coast might remember Bradley's, but it was like the lowest chain store you could go to. Like it was below Caldor's. And I ran to the vinyl section and I got Convoy by C.W. McCall and I bought it and I took it home and I listened to it, I'm not exaggerating, probably 40 times in a row.
Yeah.
There was a point where like the song would end and I was like, that was so great. I just need to hear it again. And I really do feel like at that point, my mom could have figured out, one, that I was probably going to be a musician, and sure. two, that I had some severe alcoholic drug addict tendency.
Okay. That's so interesting. I mean, you know, I remember those days of getting that record, whatever it was at the time, and just, you know, it became all encompassing, right? It dominated your life and your attention for whatever window. And I think it's, you know, those are formative experiences, right? That they really
I remember every last detail. I remember what Bradley's smelled like, you know, this weird smell of like old hot dogs and knockoff rubber sneakers with five stripes on them. Like this weird sure. pheromone of just fried food and sadness and plastic, but it smelled perfect to me because that's where I was able to get my first 7-inch single.
Unbelievable. That's great. And then I know you grew up playing instruments. How did you start making electronic music, which obviously was not even really a thing at the time?
Yeah. I mean, I started playing guitar when I was around 9 years old. And this was also in the mid 70s. And at that point, classic rock wasn't called classic rock. It was right. just the music you heard on the radio. Like there were two yep. types of music on the radio. There was disco and there was rock. And then there was a lot of overlap, like, you know, Rod Stewart, Do You Think I'm Sexy, and the Rolling Stones, Some Girls. And I really wanted to fit in. And so I tried very hard to just play. I played classical music, I played jazz, and I tried to learn classic rock songs, like Stairway to Heaven, because my guitar teacher was obsessed with virtuoso guitar players. You know, people like Larry Carlton from Weather Report, or, you know, Jimmy Page, later Eddie Van Halen. And then in around, I guess, 1978, a few things happened. I heard The Clash on the radio. And I realized I liked this so much more than any of the, like, than the sort of banal classic rock that was being played 500 times a day. Sure. And then I heard Gary Numan and Devo. You know, Gary Numan Cars, as you might know, a lot of people would know, was a surprisingly huge hit in the late 70s in the States. And it was the first time I'd ever really heard like futuristic synth music. And so in my mind, there was like a year zero moment where, let's say it was like 1977, when, like, you know, The Clash, The Sex Pistols, Elvis Costello, Gary Numan, Devo, all of this music came out. And my friends and I, you know, we were 13, 14 years old living in Connecticut. We kind of had this unspoken agreement that we simply weren't going to listen to music made before 1977. And so we didn't care how it was made. We didn't really care who was making it, as long as it was made by people with short hair, as long as the songs weren't too long.
Yeah.
We didn't care if it was guitars or synths or drums or drum machines. And clearly a lot of the musicians back then didn't care either. I mean, you look at a band like Killing Joke, who were a punk band, but half of their songs have synthesizers. And so that, sorry for my long rambling answer, but sonically, sonically, it was very exciting because guitar music, as much as I love guitar music, like, you can't really do that much with a guitar. You know, people like Adrian Belew have experimented with it, but like a guitar 9 times out of 10 sounds like a guitar, whereas synthesizers and samplers sounded like the future. And it was impossible to resist that lure. And then obviously a lot of bands like Depeche Mode, early Human League, Heaven 17, you know, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, first few albums, like, these were so inspiring because they didn't sound like anything I'd ever heard before.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. it brings a couple of things to mind. I just had John O'Grant from Above and Beyond on the podcast, and you know, we were talking about those old days of going into Guitar Center and just playing on the synthesizers for hours on end. And you know, there was something about, you know, again, the like, to your point, a synthesizer can sound like anything. It can sound, you know, it's infinite in terms of the what you can make with it. And I think that changed, you know, changed music and changed people's creative approach.
And also it reminded me, like, I remember when I first started hearing synthesizers in new wave songs, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense, because I loved science fiction. Mm. And obviously synthesizers were the music of science fiction. So when you watch Star Trek, when you watch Space 1999, you know, even 2001, Clockwork Orange, like the soundtrack was synthesizers.
Yeah.
And it just seemed so exciting that in the late 70s into the early 80s, like, people were taking that aesthetic, that sonic quality of futurism, and making songs around it. And obviously a lot of the musicians who were very open-minded at the time embraced this. I mean, you think of like David Bowie's like Low, Heroes, Station to Station, like synthesizers everywhere, drum machines everywhere. And so it just sort of, almost like David Bowie and Eno making those records kind of gave electronic music this imprimatur of legitimacy. You know, we were like, well, if David Bowie and Brian Eno, who had produced Devo and the Talking Heads, you know, if they're interested in these instruments and this music, then clearly this is what we should be paying attention to.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I didn't want to jump ahead too much, but you said something that I find so interesting about, you know, at that age, having this rule, we're not going to listen to any music made before whatever the year is. And I remember, you know, I think that's part of youth, is we draw these really clear rules. I listen to this music and not that music, or, you know, that group on the other side of high school likes, you know, these bands, so therefore I don't. And then, you know, cut that against play, where you referenced and sampled all of these old blues records, all of which were before that cutoff date that you referred to earlier. And I, you know, I just find that so interesting, that like how the rules change as we get older. And, you know, it sometimes seem absurd, or sometimes, you know, served a purpose.
Oh yeah. I mean, like I was referring to that year zero moment for punk rock and new wave, at least in suburban Connecticut and then in New York, we'll call it 1975, 1976. And then every now and then something would pop through. Like, I remember the first time I heard the band Suicide, and I fell in love with that. And someone said, oh, you know, they've been around since 1971. And I was like, oh. And then finding out that Devo had started in the early 70s, and then hearing Silver Apples, you know, this music that came from the 60s and 70s. And that forced me to reevaluate my year zero criteria.
Totally.
And then, of course, as time passed, especially with the advent of the sampler, you know, when I remember when I first really started hearing sample-based electronic music, like Eric B. and Rakim, and thinking, oh, they're like, basically the recorded music library can be repurposed however you want. And that changed. I mean, obviously I'm not alone in saying that, but like all of a sudden everyone was like, wow, we can look at anything that's ever been recorded and repurpose it.
Sure.
And that just changes the way you see music. 'Cause in a way, you're like, not to sound too utilitarian, but like a lot of older recorded music, the way you assess it isn't necessarily based on, do you like this song, but rather, can you repurpose these 3 seconds or these 8 seconds or these 12 seconds?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that reminds me of, you know, there's been all these viral videos recently of people showing how One More Time, how Daft Punk sampled whatever that old record was for One More Time and completely flipped it. And, you know, it sounds nothing like the original, but, you know, in their minds, you know, hearing that record sparked something for them to do something totally unique with this, you know, tiny clip of an old record, that obscure record that nobody had ever heard of.
And yeah. I mean, that's the nature of sample technology, is like every now and then someone would sample an entire song, but for the most part, like finding that break, finding that little snippet. And then of course the excitement of going back and rediscovering obscure music from musical traditions that I had never been exposed to. I remember the first time I heard that one and only Baby Huey album, which if you've never heard it, is phenomenal. And he made this one album, Kurt Mayfield produced it, and then he died. And that record has been sampled so much. And that's an interesting case where the source material is better than anybody who's ever sampled it, you know, which is maybe happens every now and then. Like sometimes you can sample something old where the original song was never really that good.
Sure.
But in that, like in some cases, the original song is just phenomenal. And so you would hear a sample and you'd go back and figure out where it was from. And now, to state the obvious, like an old person, now it's a lot easier because everything's fine. But back then, to find the source material, you had to literally dig through record crates. You had to go to all these secondhand stores and like have conversations with people working in the stores. And oftentimes they wouldn't tell you their secret knowledge of like, you know, where did the 45 King get the 900 number from? Mm-hmm. Like this almost like sacred knowledge that was just held by a few people.
Absolutely. So going back to your journey a little bit, I know that Go, your first single, was a very kind of minor hit when it first came out, and then, you know, with the remix became a big hit across Europe and around the world. Take me back to that feeling that this was really happening, that music was becoming your career, that there was a success there.
Okay. I mean, it was, so 1989, I signed my first record deal, and to put it in context, the label I signed to was called Instinct Records. But when I signed with them, they didn't have a name. They didn't have a logo. They'd never released records before. So it was really more just an idea between these two guys.
Sure.
But I was so desperate to sign a record deal, I signed a record deal with a company that didn't have a name. And then I spent a couple of years being the sort of like the office boy. Like I would clean the office. I would, you know, take stuff to UPS. I would take stuff to the post office, but I'd also be making records. And we invented all these different names so that the label would seem like it had a very diverse roster. You know, for example, the first Instinct Records compilation has six artists on it. And it was all just me working under different names.
Fantastic.
And Go was this super weird minimalist track. And then I heard Angelo Badalamenti's Laura Palmer's theme from Twin Peaks, and I replayed it over this minimal techno track. And I mean, I thought I was working in this incredibly obscure genre of, you know, house music, early techno.
Sure.
You know, it was so underground, not by choice. Like, we weren't rejecting the mainstream necessarily, but like when you were part of the electronic music world in New York, there were 10 other people.
Yeah.
You know, so it was me and Joey Beltram, and then like the people at Strictly and Craig Coleman at Big Beat. Like, these people were like, it was all super minor and underground. And then all of a sudden, almost overnight, all of us became huge stars in Europe with top 10 records. And it was very exciting, but so unexpected. Like, because we were working in a genre and we were working in a milieu where you just didn't expect to have success. Like,
yeah,
you know, like if you're a hip hop producer or a pop producer, or back then, if you were playing in a hair metal band, if you found success, you'd be excited, but you were working in a genre where there was so much precedent for existing success. And there were so many people who had charted trajectories leading to success.
Sure.
Whereas if you're an underground electronic music producer in New York in 1990, you didn't know anyone who'd ever had success. Like, success was playing a show for 30 people.
Right. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you go from playing a show, you know, like your friend DB promotes a show at what's now the Mercury Lounge, and there are 35 people there, and that's a big deal. It's a big success. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you fly to the UK and you're playing at a rave for 10,000 people and you're on Top of the Pops.
Crazy.
So it was super exciting and completely unexpected.
And are you, obviously so much has changed since then for the world and for you. Are you able to sort of tap into that excitement at this stage? Like, do you use those memories and those kind of feelings at any point now?
I mean, the excitement that I have for music has not waned or abated at all. The one thing I will say is a lot of my excitement now is music almost divorced from cultural context. You know, back then, I loved house music and techno for the music, but also for the world it was coming from and the world it represented. You know, this underground world of cool record stores and interesting venues and really interesting people. And, you know, it was very contextual and very cultural. And now when I listen to music, I'm not really thinking about who's made it or where it's come from. I'm just responding to the music itself.
And do you think that's more? Yeah. Do you think that's more of a change in you, or is it a change? You know, again, I remember the time when, you know, the people making this music were, you could count them on a couple hands. Right. And, you know, we were all part of this very small community, that, you know, now doesn't exist in the same way. Right now, every kid in his bedroom can be part of that, or can make the same type of output. So I wonder if that is that cultural context more about you and where you're at today, or is it more just about where culture's at?
I think a little of both. I mean, back then, yeah. I mean, there was a sort of accidental exclusivity, meaning if you knew how to make electronic instruments work together, you were already in the most rarefied group of people. Like, if you could figure out how to 303 with a DIN sync to MIDI converter, sync up with your 909 to sync up with your Alesis sequencer, to have the audio going through some mixer you bought off the back of a truck outside Rogue Music with a weird old, like, it was just producing the music was so weird and so challenging that very few people did it.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I mean, it was a tiny world. I mean, everybody knew everybody, you know, like I knew Derek May and Jeff Mills, and you knew the labels, and you knew, like, it was rare in the late 80s, early 90s to hear about someone making music and you didn't already know them.
Sure.
You know, and then it was usually a 19-year-old kid. And then you would realize, like, oh, that's that kid I see at Liquid Sky. That's the kid I've seen here. That's, you know, like, so it was a tiny little world. And also, to sort of state the obvious, but it's also very interesting, is like the genres were brand new. I mean, in 1989, techno was 6 months old. House music was 2 years old. The technology was new. Sampling technology had just sort of barely been democratized.
Yeah.
And so everything was brand new and tiny and weird and obscure. And now it's not, which is not a criticism or a complaint, but it's just the context, I mean, considering, as you mentioned, there are probably over 100 million people on the planet right now making electronic music. Like, you Absolutely. Can't possibly keep track of that. If anyone tried, you would have to be some sort of like AI supercomputer to be aware of the hundreds of millions of people making electronic music right now.
Yeah. So how do you carry that with you? So you've got this new label, Always Centered at Night. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, you come from an era that's really driven by genre, right? And I'm a punk musician, or I'm a techno musician, or whatever. And by definition, that means I'm not all these other things, right? It shuts things out. And now you're launching a label in an era where genre plays a very different role. I think it's an overstatement to say that it doesn't exist. I think it's still important in a lot of ways, but it's not what it used to be. And so I wonder, how do you think about that in the context of your vision for the music that you want to release on your label?
Well, in a way, back then, genre was the function or result of a bunch of different kind of embedded variables. You know, one was, how was the music being made and recorded? You know, a rock band used guitars and microphones. An electronic musician used cables going into a mixing desk. Like, the production of the music Sure. was so different. And also back then, there was such a financial aspect to it. Like, if you were going to be a rock band, that was an investment. You had to spend Right. years playing instruments, going to very expensive recording studios. And if you were going to be an electronic musician, you had to pick a different lane, because it was, again, such an investment of time and money. And then the consumer, you know, think about records when they were $10, CDs when they were $18. Like, you were investing so much money, and you had to have allegiance to a genre. Like, you couldn't just go into a record store and buy 500 records and figure out what you liked. Whereas now, producing music for most people costs nothing.
Right.
Practically speaking, you get a piece of software, you produce a piece of music, like, the production cost can be $0. Mm-hmm. And buying music barely exists. Like, buying music is such a niche hobby at this point. So genre is in many ways arbitrary. Mm-hmm. The only time it's not arbitrary really is for DJs.
Sure.
You know, like, if you, and to state the obvious, if you are a house DJ, you can't really play hip hop. Like, the BPMs, the production, the kick drums, the compression, that just doesn't work. Like, you, to go from one track to the next, you kind of need to stay within a genre. You know, I know, like, back when I used to DJ, every now and then I'd try and go to a different genre, and it just felt like people would get so, even going from like house music to breakbeats.
Right.
And people would be like, what's going on? We don't understand. So, So that's the only way in which I think genre is now externally supported, is when you're DJing and you sort of need to keep your job, but you need to stay within a genre lane. Whereas for everybody else, it's like, sure, go on Spotify and listen to Metallica, and then listen to WC, and then listen to Burial, and then listen to Massive Attack, and then listen to Pantera. Hmm. You know, and it doesn't cost anything, and you're doing it in the privacy of your own home. So regarding a label, like, I mean, I don't, Always Centered at Night, I don't think it certainly doesn't have a genre allegiance. It almost has a historical inspiration, which is, you know, growing up in and around New York in the 70s and the 80s. And I would say it's also, there is a subtext of, and I'm going to try and say this very diplomatically, but there's a subtext of rejection.
Okay.
Meaning, I find, and maybe this is a bad thing to say, but so much music and so much production these days is so compromised. You know, it's people, and I don't criticize them, I don't criticize what they're doing, but it's people desperately bending over backwards, trying to get attention on social media, trying to get something going. And I appreciate that, but the end result is a lot of music that's very anodyne and watered down. And I really like the idea of having a label that's a home for music that simply doesn't compromise in that way. Mm-hmm.
That's great. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and you know, having this sort of unexpected hit in Europe. I watched your Moby Doc in preparation for this, and for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's fantastic. Not only, you know, for fans of yours, but I think just, you know, great story of humanity and of the tremendous ups and downs that I think, you know, you've experienced probably greater highs and greater lows than most people. And so I wonder, what has that taught you about expectation?
A lot of things. And by the way, thank you for saying that you like Moby Doc, because it's definitely an unconventional movie.
Yeah. That's one of the things I liked about it.
Yeah, that was because there's so many normal documentaries out there. It's like, well, if you don't have to make something normal, then why? Like, why conform to convention if the convention is uninspiring and arbitrary? So the ups and downs, the lessons learned, and it's definitely a function of being old when you realize that, like, people start asking you about what lessons you've learned, and you realize, like, oh, I actually think I have learned some things. And one is sort of like this, a lot, the self-evident aspect of the outside world, the world of validation, the world of being celebrated, the world of material success. It can be fine, but it doesn't deliver sustainable well-being or happiness. And it's one of these lessons that you kind of have to go through it yourself to learn that. And so even though I have not really enjoyed the down periods, I'm grateful for what I've learned from them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, we can look at, like, for example, Donald Trump seems like the least happy person on the planet. Kanye is a billionaire and he's miserable. Elon Musk is the wealthiest person on the planet, and he just seems like an angry lunatic. On and on. It's like, there's so many people who've won the lottery, literally or figuratively, regarding fame and success and wealth, and they either kill themselves, or they're miserable, or they're abusive, or they're addicts. So, but I guarantee you, everybody looking at them thinks, like, wow, if I had their money and success, I'd be so happy. And it's like, well, but no one ever has been.
Right.
You know, I can't think of one person who has found sustainable happiness and well-being from external validation, from wealth. Like, I've met thousands and thousands of very successful, very wealthy people, and none of them seem terribly happy. So, which is not, like, a degree of affluence is nice. Like, it's nice to be warm in the winter, and it's nice to have food in the fridge and be able to pay the rent. Like, all that is great.
Sure.
But I think I had made this assumption when I was growing up, and it's an assumption that I believe a lot of people make, which is, if you find the right assembly of stuff, you know, like the right amount of fame, the right amount of money, the right amount of validation, the right amount of hedonism and degeneracy, then all of a sudden you'll be happy. And it didn't work for me. And I have yet to meet someone who it's worked for. You know, I live in LA, which is the land of people expecting fame, youth, money, et cetera, to deliver happiness, and then doesn't seem to. And I lived in New York, also the land of that. London, like, all these places I've lived in, and I've met the wealthiest, most famous, most beautiful, most successful people. And I guarantee you, none of them are happy in a way that is sustainable unless they have figured out a way of almost transcending circumstances. Mm.
So two questions come to mind. One, where are you finding happiness today? What is the sustainable model that works for you? And two, you know, what you say is such a valuable lesson. And it is, as guys in our 50s, it is like, we tend to get to this point, if at all, later in life, right? Where we realize all the things we thought were going to bring us happiness in our youth didn't work. And so now, having a label and working with young artists, where you're sort of the elder statesman, can you impart that? Can you pass that down and allow them to learn from your lesson, or are young artists just gonna go through it on their own and it falls on deaf ears?
Yeah, it's a great question. Like, and I presumptuously, there's a part of me that wants to hope that, you know, taking the life lessons I've learned and imparting them to other people might help other people. But with so many things, like, I feel like people have to go through it themselves.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can't live other people's experiences for them. You can talk to them and you can say, hey, I went through all this and it didn't work. And they're like, yeah, that sucks for you, but if I went through it, I'd be so happy. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, okay. Thinking of Avicii and Kurt Cobain and Amy Winehouse and et cetera, et cetera. There's no evidence to support that, but everyone has to go through it themselves. But regarding the earlier question of happiness now, so I remember about 15 years ago, I was dating a woman who was a Buddhist, and she gave me a Dalai Lama book for my birthday. And at the time, I was like battling alcoholism and addiction, and I was in a very bad, dark place. And I was like, okay, maybe this book will fix me. And I started reading it, and one of the first things in the book, I don't even remember the name of the book, was basically the Dalai Lama talking about how happiness results from being of service. Mm-hmm. And I was so annoyed by that. And I stopped reading the book. I was like, I don't want to be of service. I don't want to put other people's needs ahead of my own. I don't want to focus on things that are bigger than me. Like, I just want to be a selfish degenerate. But then I got sober, time passed, and I slowly realized this weird paradox that the more you prioritize selfishness, the less happy you are. And the more you focus on spirituality, on service, the happier you are. Mm-hmm. And part of it is a result of, and it's going to sound super pretentious. Then again, most things I say sound super pretentious, but it's almost like existential chaos theory, where a lot of selfishness and a lot of hedonism is very linear in a way that people expect selfishness and hedonism to have a direct line, like cause and effect to happiness. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way the universe works. The universe is 15 billion years old, comprised of a trillion galaxies beyond, so vast and ancient beyond our imagining, but we want to control things. And part of happiness is recognizing, like, oh, not only can I not control things, but I shouldn't. Because when I do control things, I don't do a very good job at it. Mm. And part of that, and then the knock-on effect of that is saying, like, okay, well, what are the consequences of living in a selfish world? And it's, you know, people destroying animals, people hurting each other, people destroying the environment. You know, it's all the product of a broken species. And so then the question is, like, okay, well, presumptuously, how can I try and be of service to this broken species, to try and make things not stupid and broken. And the last thing I'll say in my pretentious soliloquy is looking at the universe, you know, whether it's science, whether it's spirituality, and recognizing how unbelievably fascinating and complicated it is. And the last thing I'll say about that is about 10 years ago, I was at David Lynch's house, which is some good name dropping. And David had this super fancy microscope and he loaned it to me and I took it home and I started looking at things in the microscope. And it was just this, all of a sudden I sort of had this sense of like, oh, the universe is so vast and so complicated and so unbelievably, I don't want intelligent, and it put human perspective and human culture in a light that I was like, oh, humans know nothing. And as a human, I know nothing. And nothing is worse than knowing nothing and thinking you know a lot. So sorry for my long-winded spiel, but you tapped into something I spend way too much time thinking about.
No, I like that. That resonates with me in a big way. And I don't want to make this about myself, but I'm married 19 years. And about 2 years ago, I had a moment where I thought, you know, marriage is okay. We're here, whatever, but it could be better. And so I thought, you know, what if I approach every day and every interaction with my wife from the perspective of how can I be the absolute best husband? And not thinking about myself and what and how good a wife she was being to me, but thinking about, and I look at it from a what I would label a selfish perspective, which is I get now a roommate, a life partner, who constantly feels loved, appreciated, valued, as opposed to judged, criticized, or whatever the things we do in relationships that are totally natural and come up. And my life, forget about hers, my life is so much better now that I infuse that thinking into my actions. And that's on a micro scale of 1-to-1, right? But what taking that to what you're saying around the world and throughout humanity and other living creatures, I think that's incredibly powerful. And you know, for me it took 50 years to get to that point.
Yeah. I mean it is and congratulations, and I mean that sincerely, on getting there, because you're in that sort of like 0.01% of people who I think will ever figure that out. Because there is, you know, the dominant paradigm in our, and maybe it's because we live in the United States and I read the news too much, but the dominant paradigm is like the Trump paradigm, the Elon Musk, Kanye paradigm of like, give me power, give me more, make it about me, give me success. The more power and success and external validation I have, the happier I'll be. And it's like, well, why do they keep doing the same thing when it's clearly not making them happy? Yeah. You know, when it's clear, and like, because it requires that reset that you just described of like recognizing that the selfish modality paradoxically doesn't create happiness, but it's so hard because it's so easy. Like speaking for myself, it's so easy to be selfish.
Of course.
You know, it's almost like hardwired. I
mean, it's visceral, right? Yeah, absolutely. So thinking about that sort of elder statesman, I know, you know, in the documentary you talked about becoming neighbors and then close friends with Bowie, who's a hero, and I know you said he was an idol of yours. What'd you learn from him?
Well, I learned that no one escapes the human condition, as obvious or esoteric as that might sound, meaning like he's David Bowie, he's the king of humanity, like one of the most remarkable artists, musicians, vocalists, lyricists who's ever existed. He was still human. Mm-hmm. You know, he was still a little worried about what people thought. He was still you know, a delightful human being. You know, he, no one, I mean, I've met the Dalai Lama, I've met Thich Nhat Hanh, I met David Bowie, I've met presidents. No one transcends the human condition. Hmm. It just, it doesn't, there's no such thing as a transcendent human, at least not that I've ever met. Like, everyone still goes to the bathroom, everyone still gets scared, everyone still gets upset when they get sick, everyone still faces mortality. Like, no one transcends or is exempted from that. And so from Bowie, what I also learned, and it was a question I got asked a while ago, is like, you know, the people I've met, the people I've been friends with, the people I've worked with, like, what do they have in common? And it's the most, and I had to think about it. I was like, well, okay, what does, you know, like, everybody from David Bowie to David Lynch to whomever, like, what do they have in common? And it's one thing, which is enthusiasm. Mm. You know, the one quality I've found with the geniuses I've been friends with and worked with is enthusiasm. Like, they're not cynical. They're not bitter. They just love what they're working on, and they love what other people are working on. And that is the, that's the quality that will sustain people for decades. Like, bitterness, cynicism, dismissiveness, snarkiness, like, these things might be fun, but nothing great ever comes from them.
Sure. Yeah. So how do you tap into that when your enthusiasm is sometimes hard to sustain? You know, life gets in the way, or, you know, bitterness and cynicism crop up, and they're totally understandable. So what do you tap into?
I guess one could say that maybe there is a hereditary aspect to it, because I guess I'm very fortunate, and I've always been able to find things that I was incredibly enthusiastic about. But I would say part of it is, and I'm going to sound like an old hippie, but part of it's like being willing to pay attention. A lot of people don't trust their enthusiasm. You know, people like, oh, well, I can only be enthusiastic about certain things. Like, I live in, I'm sure you experience this all the time as well. Like, people who can only be enthusiastic about their creative output when it's validated by other people.
Sure.
You know, someone who works at a record company who can only be excited about a record that generates revenue. Like, that's understandable, but depressing, you know, like, mm-hmm. I think the enthusiasm just has to be like, right now, I'm having a great time talking with you. I'm comfortable. When we're done talking, I'm going to go have a delicious lunch, and I'm going to read a fun book. And then maybe I'm going to go outside and go for a hike. Like, I feel like a dog, where like everything that's I'm presented with, I'm super enthusiastic about. Like, and maybe that's annoying, but it's certainly better than that, you know, the cynicism and despair that would be the opposite of that.
Sure. Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, you mentioned record labels, and I think, you know, I was reminded of the story of, I think it was Stairway to Heaven that came out and was not working at radio or whatever. And you know, the guy, I forget who it was, but, you know, the guy that signed it just refused to give up. And he chased that record, and he forced it down people's throats for like a year before it broke. And I think, you know, of course he wanted to make money, and was, but he was also being told by the market that this was not a moneymaker, right? That, mm-hmm. that the market wasn't interested in this. And he just, you know, he just believed they were wrong, and that his enthusiasm, and the record business is full of examples of that, of things that didn't work, and then some person just refused to ever give up.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that there are a couple ways to look at that. One is that passion, like going at, like believing like, okay, if no one gets this, I still love it. And you keep pushing, and you hope that other people at some point will recognize how great that thing is that you love, but oftentimes they don't. Yeah. And part of happiness is being okay with that. You know, like, I fully accept that like 99% of the music I've made, no one really listens to, you know, borne out by Spotify numbers. It's like, I've got a handful of songs, that are in the sort of like hundreds of millions of listens. And then I've got a majority of songs that no one really pays attention to. And it's okay, because I loved making them. I believe in them. I think most of them have integrity and they're interesting. And whether people like celebrate me for it, it sort of has to be beside the point.
Yeah.
Because the story, like Stairway to Heaven, is a great story. I mean, I just listened to it recently, and like it's actually like an unbelievable, everything about it's just such a phenomenal song.
Sure.
One of my favorite stories is Sound of Silence.
Mm.
It's so
I don't know the story.
It's Simon and Garfunkel were a folk duo,
mm-hmm.
and they recorded Sounds of Silence as a folk song. You know, so it's guitar and vocals, and that's it. And they released it, and nothing happened. And Paul Simon, I believe, went to the UK to go to university. And a producer at Columbia heard Sounds of Silence and loved it, and of his own volition, took it into a studio and hired musicians to add the drums and electric guitar and bass on it. And they released it, and apparently it became a huge hit, and someone at Columbia called Paul Simon in the UK and said, oh, you might want to come back to the States because you have a number one record.
Oh, wow.
So it's, yeah, I forget the name of the producer who did that, but he was this amazing sort of unsung Columbia producer who was behind so many amazing records. But it's, yeah, it's that enthusiasm and love for the song, for the whatever it might be, and the process of making it, and not just being focused on the outcome, you know, because we can't control the outcome. And especially, sorry to sound like an old cranky guy, but like a lot of very successful music today is not all that interesting. You know, I hear a lot of it, I'm like, well, sounds like the musical equivalent of a sad shopping mall. And if that's what success is it worth, again, is it worth accommodating a culture that is not worthy of respect? So it makes it a little easier to sort of, you know, ignore and reject, you know, a lot of what's going on in contemporary culture because it is so uninspiring.
Sure. So how are you using that then in the new label? How, in terms of the artists you choose to work with, and the I know you've got a new record with Jose James that I just heard this morning. That's awesome.
Maybe I didn't do all the things that you
How do you think about that? Who you want to collaborate with, what you want to put out into the world?
For me, it's that very subjective element. Partially, I recognize that I'm not a great singer. And if I want to have great voices on my records, I have to work with other people or find mm-hmm. beautiful old samples. It used to frustrate me that I was not a great singer, but now I just sort of accepted, like, oh, if I was a great singer, I wouldn't be able to work with all these different people. So the voice is such a huge part of it for me. And listening to people's voices, and I realized quite a long time ago, I'm never interested in generic perfection. You know, I'm interested in that, like a voice that has, you know, that is very good, but that has a quality to it that sounds like humanity as opposed to a generic voice. You know, so I've worked, I mean, everyone from Kris Kristofferson and Mark Lanegan and Bowie, and I used to play a lot of music with Lou Reed, and like people whose voices just sounded like the human experience as opposed to like a 19-year-old pop star who just sounds like they could be singing a toothpaste commercial.
Yeah, that's great. There's a quote that I read of yours about, it says you have a disdain for our current fear-driven, algorithmic-based culture, which I think is kind of what you're referring to. So How does that impact your approach to building this label, which so much of music marketing, discovery, consumption is algorithmic driven? How does that work?
From my perspective, you do your best, you know, in terms of like writing music, recording music, finishing music, releasing music. You make sure that you feel like every part of the process has integrity and that every part is interesting, and you release it and you just sort of, I don't know, put things out into this democratic chaos, you know, this, the world of media and content, where you put stuff out into the world and you do your best. Like, you try and draw some attention to it. You hope for the best. But with the understanding that there are 30,000 pieces of music being released every day. And, sure. You know, so, you know, a friend of mine who's a musician has for the last few years felt very slighted because their streaming numbers weren't as good as they had used to be or that they think they should be. And I was like, yeah, unless you're Taylor Swift or Lizzo, like, right, that's true for everybody. Like, doesn't matter who you are. Like,
don't take it personally.
Yeah. Like, if you've released an album and you're not thrilled with how the fact that people aren't listening to the album, it's like, guess what? They don't listen to albums unless you're Taylor Swift. Like, and so it's very hard to take this culture personally. You know, there's so much music out there. There's so much content out there. Rather than be depressed when something doesn't connect, you should just be stunned and amazed when something does.
Sure.
And again, like, enjoy the process of making it, enjoy the process of collaboration, enjoy the process of making remixes and making videos and making artwork and finishing things. Like, enjoy every part of the process. And then once it's out there, you just sort of hope for the best. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. You can't take it personally.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, and I think not to give you business advice, but I think the music industry in general got so euphoric about streaming because all of a sudden there's revenue that there hadn't been, and completely, for the most part, forgot about physical product. And I know a bunch of friends and people I work with who do tremendous business still selling vinyl, CDs, you know, ancillary products related to, but, you know, have taken that commerce relationship with fans very seriously and haven't just abandoned it and let Spotify kind of handle all of it. And for those people, that seems to be working really well. And I think, you know, to your point, that's not going to work for everybody. But I think, you know, most artists and labels need to take their commerce relationship with fans more seriously, you know, other than when they go on tour, which seems to be the only time people really pay attention to that.
Yeah. And then I completely agree. And then there's one other aspect, which is the bedrock of everything we're talking about regarding music. And I'm once again going to sound like a weird old hippie, but like, which is the inherently spiritual, esoteric nature of music itself. Mm. About 20 years ago, I started working with Oliver Sacks and Dr. Connie Tomeno at this organization called the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function.
Oh, wow.
And what they do is look at music as an actual healing modality. Like, and the science is very complicated, like using fMRIs and PET scans to look at how music sort of like promotes neurogenesis in the hippocampus and decreases cortisol and other stress hormones. Music is a phenomenal healing modality. And the reason I mention that is because working with them and working with that organization, it made me realize that music is not necessarily my music, but music in general is so profound and unique as an art form, because all it is ever, all music has ever been, is air molecules moving a little bit differently. Hmm. And we take a step back and you think about that, like, think of 100,000 people in a stadium jumping up and down. Like, it's so profound, so huge and powerful. All they're doing is the air is moving a little differently. Mm-hmm. Just the air is moving. There's no physical substance to music, which is, I agree with you regarding physical product, but music sure. itself yeah. has only ever been, unless maybe in water, it's air molecules being pushed around a little bit differently than a jackhammer or a crying baby or traffic.
Yeah,
and that and the relationship that people have to it, like, as we said, like 100,000 people in a stadium jumping up and down, people at church listening to music during a funeral and weeping, people at home listening to music to sleep, people dancing and having these profound experiences to air molecules being pushed around. And in a way, that's what I'm, like, as a musician, like, that's what I'm in service to, is like that. And it's a tricky thing to talk about because it does sound very new agey, but like that esoteric power of music to reach people in the most intimate, powerful ways. And if I can, so like the fact that I'm a part of that, it's like everything else, whether it's revenue, record sales, external validation, reviews, et cetera, like that's all fun. But ultimately there has to be that focus on that powerful, esoteric, inherent quality of music.
Yeah, I love that. I love that, and that's probably, I could keep talking to you all day, but that's probably a good place to wrap and let you get on with the rest of your life. I do have a quick lightning round, if you don't mind indulging me for just a couple minutes.
Okay.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
Favorite city to travel to? You know, I hate to say it because it's so obvious, but like, is going back to New York, because I was born in New York. I spent most of my life living in New York, and going back, because I don't live there anymore. When I go back, I'm reminded of how beautiful it is, you know, and it's the bridges and the rivers and Central Park. Like, when I lived there, I rarely recognize the beauty of it. Sure. And now when I go back, I just see the fizz, like this, how many cities are basically completely surrounded by water, which might not do too well as the climate changes, but that it's such yeah. a constant, like that fascinating physical beauty, the architecture, the bridges, the rivers, etc.
I love it. Who's your favorite DJ?
My favorite DJ is Shepard Fairey. Shepard DJs a lot in Los Angeles, usually at yeah. charity. And he is the most eclectic DJ. And granted, we grew up with the same records. So every time I go hear him DJ, he plays something that completely surprises me. Like the last time I went to hear him DJ, he played one of the Public Image Limited songs from Second Edition. Mm. I forget which one it was. Maybe it was even one of the instrumentals. And I was like, I haven't heard this in forever. So yeah, definitely Shepard Fairey as my favorite DJ.
That's awesome. I love Shepard. My house is filled with his artwork, and I've seen him DJ a bunch of times, but he's
yeah, not, and he keeps doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the music he plays, it's just, every single time he's surprised me with something I just wasn't expecting.
That's great. What's the last great book you read?
The last great book? Well, I read a lot of fiction that I'm not proud of.
Give an example of that.
See, when I started touring 500 years ago, I started buying airport fiction.
Okay.
And before that, I had been a literary snob. You know, I was a philosophy major at college, so I only read philosophy, and I read, you know, Eyeless and Gaza by Aldous Huxley. Like, I was such a snob. And then for the last couple of decades, I've read the stuff that you see in airports, like Michael Connelly and Harlan Coben, and, you know, the fun page turners. So the last great book, because I do read a lot of fiction that wouldn't necessarily be described. It's really fun, but it's not great. Okay, you know what? It's an honest answer, but it's also another hippie esoteric answer. Is when I was 16, I had the biggest crush on a woman who was obsessed with Taoism.
Okay.
And to impress her, I went out and got a copy of the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, if there was ever a person named Lao Tzu. And it didn't impress her. We never dated. She went off to Brown and forgot about me. But I kept this copy of the Tao Te Ching. And I recently, at the beginning of the pandemic, went back and sort of rediscovered it. And it might be the greatest book of spiritual wisdom I've ever encountered. Like, I'd sort of forgotten how insightful and remarkable it is. And it was written 3,500 years ago.
Yeah. I love that. That's a book I reread every few years, and it's maybe the only sort of spiritual book that I reread. So that's great. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
And again, I'm trying to think of a better answer, but the honest answer is Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
All three of the, you know, because when I was growing up, I was obsessed with The Hobbit, you know, the books and The Lord of the Rings. And I even tried reading The Silmarillion when I was growing up. And I used to make maps based on J.R.R. Tolkien. And I have to say, like, I love when enough time has passed that I can watch Lord of the Rings again and not remember every word of dialogue.
Mm. Yeah, that's cool. So who's someone you haven't met, but you've learned a lot from?
Haven't met, living or dead?
Could be either, or fictional, or whoever's taught you.
So there's the Sufi poet. In fact, Sufi poets in general, like, I know you mentioned that you go back to the Tao Te Ching every couple of years, like, reading some Sufi poetry is also a thing I go back to often, which is tricky because obviously, like, Rumi is, like, on every single herbal tea bag and, you know, it's very overquoted, but, like, the underlying premise of Sufi poetry I find to be really inspiring. And so rather than pick a person, I'd say one of those three main Sufi poets, like Kabir, Hafiz, and Rumi, just, you know, I get a lot of inspiration and delight from reading their poetry.
That's cool. So last question, if I worked for you, let's say I worked at the label, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
I mean, unfortunately, let me think. I'm going to say, that's a good question. I don't know, because I think in some ways I'm a good boss and in some ways I'm a terrible boss.
Give me one example of each of those.
I guess I can be a little, okay, being a good boss is like, I hope I'm generous. I mean, the people I work with, I kind of respect and encourage their creativity. I hope I give them good bonuses and lots of time off whenever they want it. And I give them really interesting projects to work on with a lot of autonomy. So I hope I'm good in that way. And I hope that the fact that I try not to work on things that involve compromise, I hope that people I work with feel like that they're working on things that have integrity. But I do sometimes get a little bit type A in a way that I'm not thrilled with. But part of it is I don't say this as a brag, but like I work a lot. Like I work 7 days a week. I don't take days off. I usually start work around 4 or 5 in the morning. It's a very weird, almost monastic approach to work. And every now and then I unfortunately hold other people to this standard, even though I fully accept that lots of other people like to do things other than work or go hiking or read airport fiction. Whereas for me, I work and I hike and I read airport fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really common trait among entrepreneurs, business owners, right? Is that we work all the time and it's tempting or easy to expect everyone else around us to behave the same way, and they don't.
People like to take vacations. People like to spend time with their family. People
sure
like to go to parties. Like I hate the idea of going on vacation. I love my family, but I don't really want to go to family events. And the idea of going to a party, it's like, well, why? Like, why? You know, like what's the, I feel a little bit like a robot when it comes to the normal stuff that humans do. So I try very hard to respect people's human choices, even if in my Asperger's robot state, I don't fully understand them.
I get it. Moby, thanks for doing this, man. It's so much fun talking with you. I really
appreciate my pleasure.
It.
I feel like I owe you money for therapy.
No, it's been super fun. I hope we can do it again sometime. And in the meantime, we'll be watching for everything coming out from you and the label.
Yeah, really nice speaking with you. Have a great rest of the day.
Yeah, that was Moby on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you check us out on YouTube. We have videos of all of our episodes. And if you have questions for us, you can hit us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever. Most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.